De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary. This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
We're here for I Guess It Was My Destiny to Live So Long, exploring the work of June Jordan. Is that right? Yeah. Woo! All right. We're here with Hanif Abdurraqib, who is a poet, essayist, and cultural critic from Columbus, Ohio. The appropriate due for Columbus. Thank you. Thank you, Hanif, for coming.
Thank you, everybody. Is this on? Yes. Okay. Well, it's good to be here, and it's good to see Maya and Erica and, like, so many people who I, we're gonna get to June Jordan eventually, but we're gonna begin in a couple other places, and then we're gonna get to June, and then we might go somewhere else, but largely, I was, as I arrived and as I heard the stories of other talks, I was like, well, my shit's kind of like a craft talk. Like, this isn't really but it is a craft talk that will orbit the realities of the direct address as a speaker in a text and how that can guide us towards liberation. There's a, my favorite part, there's a music documentary about John Batiste making American Symphony. And my favorite part of that is this part where he's like struggling with the orchestra to hit a note, to find a note, and then he shrugs and says, it's gonna sound how it sounds until it sounds how it sounds. And I feel very much like that's the journey we're gonna be on today. The first thing I wanna do is bring Frederick Douglass into the space, because I am fascinated by his writing and speaking on sonics. Now, one thing that I believe is important is language, and I think that many people who write or speak language or communicate effectively would say language is important, but I have grown to become a little bit more honed in on the idea that perhaps it is less what one says and how the language is delivered. And so the best argument for this, not that I think an argument needs to be made, but the best possible argument for this is the way songs traveled along the Underground Railroad, which Frederick Douglass wrote about extensively. And in these writings, it also answers the question of to whom are we directing our language. One of my favorite clips that I saw in sports, maybe last year, early this year, it's all a blur. It was early this year. LSU's women's basketball team was playing Tennessee in the SEC championship game. And Angel Reese was shooting a free throw, and there was an opponent on the foul line who was talking, like talking shit. And you can see in the clip that Angel Reese like clocks her out of the corner of her eye, and then she fully turns to her because the person who was talking was looking straight forward and talking. And Angel Reese looks at her and says, "Who the fuck are you talking to?" And it wasn't even like, it wasn't even aggressive. It was just out of pure curiosity. Like, surely, and that's the kind of dialect, that's the kind of like vernacular I think like black folks know well, where sometimes the who the fuck are you talking to is a, hopefully I can curse in here, surely we're all adults. The who the fuck are you talking to is less of a confrontational thing, but it is the step before the confrontation, right? It is the clarifying movement before a confrontation must be had, perhaps. So, it also helps you understand who is trying to, who is in the conversation and who is definitively out of the conversation. To bring Frederick Douglass in, Frederick Douglass wrote extensively about the way songs were passed along the Underground Railroad through coded language, which meant that enslaved folks were taking the songs that were being crafted or built out, these so-called spirituals that were being built out by non-black folks, and they were rewiring them, the language and the codes through them. So I'm going to read a little bit of Frederick Douglass. A silent slave is not liked by masters or overseers. Make a noise, and hear a hand are the words usually addressed to slaves when there are silenced amongst them. This may account for the almost constant singing heard in the southern states. There was, generally, more or less singing among the teamsters, as it was one's means of letting the overseer know where they were and that they were moving on with the work. But on allowance day, those who visited the great house farm were peculiarly excited and noisy. While on their way, they would make the dense old woods for miles around reverberate with their wild notes. This was not always merry because they were wild. On the contrary, they were mostly a quiet cast and told a tale of grief and sorrow. In the most boisterous outbursts of rapturous sentiment, there was an ever tinge of deep melancholy, and I have never heard any songs like those since I left slavery. He goes on to talk about O Canaan, Sweet Canaan, and how that was translated along the Underground Railroad, but more often, if you look up Frederick Douglass, he talks about Go Down Moses and how Go Down Moses, I'm not going to play, I bought a speaker because I'm going to play some stuff later, but I'm not going to play this because it's the Albert McNeil Jubilee Singers performing Go Down Moses as it might have been sung in that format. Go Down Moses and Follow the Drinking Gourd are kind of map songs that were, when communicated in this form along the Underground Railroad, using these physical places that folks know, be it Egypt or Jerusalem, to signal up or down or south or north, east or west. And I became so fascinated by this because we understand how this translates in the modern world. It's why people love cover songs, right? It's why we can sit and listen to, say, Maxwell's version of This Woman's Work and understand that in the eyes and pen of Kate Bush, that song is about the perils of childbirth, but through Maxwell's lens, it is about something entirely different because the language is being presented to us in a different way, which in a form, in one form, answers the question of who the fuck are you talking to? I tend to think of June Jordan as one of the great who the fuck are you talking to poets because of her effectiveness with direct address. And I came up, my background is in poetry slam, that's how I kind of got started, which is useful and great and vital for me. And, I almost said but, and is the right word. And I think it obscures some of that ability to address someone. You know something I don't love, I mentioned the Angel Reese clip, which I love. What I don't love, even though I understand it's just a function of the way that many people communicate on the internet and beyond, I just, I strongly dislike the way the word y'all is deployed, because it means absolutely nothing, in a sense where it's like, who are you directing your ire at? Who are you directing your rage at? If we don't actually have a framework for who we are directing our rage at, and even our like flippant online whatevers, you know, then we actually blur everyone into enemies. And if everyone is an enemy, then we have no enemies, right? I am going to read a poem that is not a June Jordan poem, but is a great example of how to use a direct address to trick people into closeness and then turn something on their ear. I may not read the whole poem because it's very long, but I'll read the whole poem. This is a Ross Gay poem, of course, because he is very good at the direct address. And I use this poem because this is a poem that, as you will see, is not about the kind of soft thing that it begins with. This poem is called Feet. Do people know this poem? I feel like of all the Ross Gay poems, this is the one that like people just don't. This is like a deep cut, but this is my favorite shit. And I'm not like a deep, I like with Ross Gay, I like all the big hits. I like the hits. Anyway, this is Feet. Friends, mine are ugly feet. The body's common wreckage stuffed into boots. The second toe on the left foot's crooked. Crooked enough that when a child asks, what's that of it? I can flinch without fear or doubt or lie that a cow stepped on it, which maybe makes them fear cows, for which I repent in love as I am with those philosophical beasts who would never smash my feet nor sneer at them the way my mother does. We always bought you good shoes, honey, she says. You can't blame us for those things. And for this and for other reasons, I have never indulged in the pleasure of flip-flops, shy or ashamed, digging my toes like 10 tiny ostriches into the sand at the beach with friends who I'm not sure loved me, though I don't think Tina loved me. She liked me, I think, but said to me as we sat down on lawn chairs beside a pool where I lifeguarded and where I was meticulous at obscuring from view with a book or towel my screwy friends, she said, "You have pretty feet," in that gaudy cement mixer Levittown accent that sends all the lemurs scaling my ribcage to see, and she actually had pretty feet, and so I took this as a kindness, incomparable, and probably fell a little bit in love with her that afternoon, with the weird white streak in her hair, and her machine gun chatter, and her gum snapping, and so slid my feet from beneath my Power Man and Iron Fist comic book into the sun, for which they acted like plants opening their tiny mouths to the food hurtling to them through the solar system, and like plants, you could watch them almost smile, almost say, "Thank you." You could watch them turn colors and be almost emboldened, none of which Tina saw, because she was probably digging in her purse, or talking about that hottie on The Real World, or yelling at some friend's little sister to put her ass in her trunks, or pouring the crumbs of her Fritos into her thrown open mouth. "But do you really think I'm talking to you about my feet?" Of course she's dead. Tina was her name, of leukemia, so I heard. Why else would I try sadly to make music of her unremarkable kindness? I'm trying, I think, to forgive myself for something I don't know what, but what I do know is that I love the moment when the poet says, "I am trying to do this," or "I am trying to do that." Sometimes it's a horseshit trick, but sometimes it's a way by which the poet says, "I wish I could tell you truly of the little factory in my head, the smokestacks, the dandelions, the willows of sweet clover playing through the backtop. I wish I could tell you how inside the steady mumble and clank of machines, but mostly I wish I could tell you of the footsteps I hear more than I can ever count." So what we get from that poem, right, is actually Ross saying the direct address is strictly to you, the listener, right? But he's also saying, come close to me and I'm going to tell you this story about this body part of mine. And you perhaps would be seduced into understanding that you are actually listening to this man talk about his feet. Even if you know Ross's poems or know Ross's work, you get sucked into this idea where you are being addressed directly, speaker to you, about feet until, of course, the rug gets pulled out from you and you're talking about death. This is the way that a direct address can be both dangerous and effective. Not saying that Ross is like a dangerous or ill-mannered writer or with ill intentions. To bring June Jordan into this, June Jordan's effectiveness, one of my favorite June Jordan poems, and I think one of the poems that is well known by now, is "I Must Become a Menace to My Enemies," and which I will not read because it's very long, but I'm going to play her reading some of some things. "I Must Become a Menace to My Enemies" utilizes, also, will you, I know I ramble, so you know.
You're good.
Thank you.
That's my whole job today.
"I Must Become a Menace to My Enemies" utilizes two forms of June Jordan's strongest ability as a writer. One of her abilities as a poet, I think, is to utilize the direct address as the eye. The eye is the weapon, right? So she is centered in chasing after whatever. And this isn't even to touch on her love poems, which I think is a whole other thing. Right now, I'm gonna like stop myself from going down the road of June Jordan as a love poet, because I think she's one of the greatest who's ever lived. But we're gonna talk about kind of her revolutionary work, right? Her politically revolutionary work. If you think about a poem like "I Must Become a Menace to My Enemies" and a lot of June Jordan's poems, let's focus on that one. There's a repetition. And what happens if we are thinking about the direct address, especially utilizing the I as an anchor, like "I must, I must, I must." Repetition does not make language lose its meaning, it makes language lose its kind of form, which means that it can become a doorway to anything. And so by the time we get to the end of "I Must Become a Menace to My Enemies," we feel collectively as though there is a clear understanding of who the enemy is. This, forgive me for citing myself, I suppose, but I'm citing myself in relationship to June Jordan. In the opening line of my book, the last book, the line is, "You will forgive me if we begin this brief time we have together by speaking about our enemies." Now, that's completely ripped from the concept of June Jordan as enemy, identifier of enemies, but it's also answering this question of power, because I am so richly averse to the collective we, the so-called collective we, and I'm really averse to the hour, and I'm really averse to this kind of assumptive speaking of collective rage. But if I am someone who on the page is saying, I'm actually going to we're going to spend some time in deep intimacy together. And before we do, I'm going to outline what I mean by an enemy. And by the time I get to the end of that outline, you might too feel broadly that this is your enemy too. That is, in some ways, an effective strategy towards, I believe, building collective power, which June Jordan did really well in her work. Across this idea, and I'm going to play a clip of June Jordan reading something, a really short clip. When I was coming up and learning how to read, not like learning how to read text, but learning how to read my own poems, you know, like I started writing poems a lot later than most of the people I know, and I didn't really know how to, the great Detroit poet Jamal May saw me read one time when I was like early in this shit, and he said this thing to me that was like, if you're going to read your poems out loud, you might as well be good at it. And I, you know, which was so important, you know, like people, it's funny or whatever, but it was like vitally important for me to hear that from a writer I admired. And so I studied, you know, I'm not very loud, I was like, I just want to hear the way, you know, I was reading June Jordan, I was like, I don't know what she sounds like. Like, I don't know what her voice sounds like. And so I studied the way she read poems. And I'm going to play a clip from a poem about police violence. And one thing I want to say about that poem and what I want to say about June Jordan is something that I hope echoes throughout so much of hopefully what is being discussed at this conference, is that the reason I believe poem about police violence is so powerful because it positions violent resistance not as something that needs to be apologized for. And it positions violent resistance as something that is actually a necessity depending on circumstance. And so June Jordan isn't saying, the cops are going to keep killing us, so maybe we should. It's just like straight up, every time they kill a black kid, we're going to kill a cop. Because what other options are there? And if we, and this is me just saying some shit outside of the specter of this talk, honestly, if we as people, or maybe again, there I just talked about how I don't fuck with the collective we, and I said we. If I continually feel the need to apologize for violent resistance and those in the throes of it, then I am complicit even further than all of us are complicit due to our taxpayer dollars or whatever, further complicit in the annihilation of the people. And it does not do me any justice to want to soften the realities that people have to survive. And people are hungry right now, and people are under siege right now, and not, if your scope of, I would hope that everyone here does not have a narrow scope, but if your scope is so narrow that it only applies to the US, then there are people under siege that are touchable to you right now. And at some point, the decision of how to resist is made for you. Here's a short clip of June Jordan reading poem about police violence. I bought a little Bluetooth speaker.
What you think would happen?
And it's not connected. Hold on.
Battery 90%. Connected to Penny's iPhone.
I can't get the speaker to pronounce my name correctly. Okay.
Tell me something. What you think would happen if every time they kill a black boy then we kill a cop? Every time they kill a black man then we kill a cop? You think the accident rate would lower subsequently?
The reason I played just that beginning clip is because if we're going to talk about both the language, as we were talking about with the Underground Railroad, right? Not just the language on the page, but the way the language is delivered. If you were to read a poem about police violence on the page, which I would hope some of you have, you would probably not adopt the cadence of June Jordan's reading poem about police violence because it's not structured that way. Like, the poem on the page is just like block texty. It's not. But that kind of the movement towards... first off, the gesture of we, and that's from a documentary about like her and Nikki Giovanni that I feel like many people haven't seen. However, not to plug something, but if you're in Brooklyn, New York, the week of November 4th, we're showing it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. We're showing the full doc, which has not, I think, been shown in full in a long time. Anyway, the gesture towards we, and the nod towards we, and the pause between... accident rate and subsequently. And these kind of gestures that are made, again, clarify who the fuck you are talking to, right? Because you're talking to people who perhaps, in the case of June Jordan, and one thing I do want to stress about June Jordan, where like our, and I am a deep June Jordan devotee, but our paths diverge in this way, is like she was very steeped in the Academy, right? I don't really have any kind of really relationship with the Academy, and so I don't, you know, but, and I don't think that diminishes, to be clear, I don't think that diminishes any of her work or efforts. I'm just saying that there are ways that she was speaking to different people at different times. And because of that, I think, is why her work is so incisive. And so when you hear her read things out loud, I'm going to play another clip of something reading her out loud, her reading out loud in a second, you hear the choices that she is making when she is directing, directly addressing an audience. And the we becomes not universal, but becomes direct just by the way that she is presenting it to the public. And so what I'm saying is, as I draw this thread between Frederick Douglass and June Jordan, what they are both saying is, it's actually, the language is not secondary, the language is important, but the actual delivery of the language undresses some of the kind of mystification of it. And the delivery of the language tells people what they need and where they need to go. Now, one other thing, and I know I have like 10 minutes of talking left, so truly, I feel bad because I do get very rambly.
You don't have to worry about the time. That's my job.
I know, but also, I know I don't have to like worry about time, but when has me not needing to worry about something ever stopped me from worrying about it? The other thing that June Jordan, and I am going to read this poem only because, do I want to read the whole thing? There's no recording, and I'm heartbroken that there's actually no recording of it. The poem, Apologies to All the People in Lebanon, is a poem of June Jordan's that I think is important because to go further down this road of direct address, which I think is the, we're going to go one block further, which is the block that most people don't like being on. The use of direct address in a sharply honed way in the poem, and I love Ross, and this is not putting Ross at odds with June Jordan. Ross, for example, and myself, I think, in the work, often use it to bring a reader, the eye, right? The eye is to bring a reader close. It's to have this kind of intimacy between speaker and reader. I says, come through the door, and there is a person waiting for you, willing to tell you a story. It isn't distant, like the Bible has that kind of omnipresent speaker voice. It isn't like that, although, you know, the Bible's got some good language from time to time, I suppose. We're going to get to gospel later. Literally, we're going to get to gospel later. Probably after questions, though. But what the eye in the work does, and what June Jordan did with the eye in the work, is treated it as a kind of weapon to self-indict. And that's maybe the bridge further that I think a lot of people don't go down. Because if you are the central point of your work, if you are choosing to lead with the eye, and you are choosing to identify the self as the both speaker and engine of the work, then one cannot come out of that unscathed. And if they are, that feels, to me, dishonest. And what I value, and I'm using this as a construct, the thing that hovers over all this, I'm talking about poems and I'm talking about a poet, but I'm also talking about the way we move through the world, right? I'm talking about the way that we move in our community spaces, I'm talking about the way that we move. If you are not moving with any sense of self-indictment, then it is going to be impossible for you to change your mind on anything worthwhile. And it's going to be impossible for you to be moved on anything worthwhile. And June Jordan, in her work, is one of the great poets of self-indictment. Without kind of like, and I think there's a fine line between self-indictment and this like self-flagellation where you're beating yourself up for having not done something, or, you know, that is less useful to me. And that part is actually returning to the ego. If you are presenting the I as I have failed and here's how I failed, that is actually an ego exercise, as opposed to saying I am struggling with the realities of the world I'm living in and the way that I'm complicit in them. Here's Apologies to All the People in Lebanon. This is a poem dedicated to the 600,000 Palestinian men, women, and children who lived in Lebanon from 1984 to 1983. And I will say, too, this is an important part of June Jordan's legacy that feels vitally important to mention. This poem really damaged her career. If you look at June Jordan's publishing history, like if you just straight up go to the bibliography on Wikipedia or whatever the fuck, and you're like, why is there that gap between like the mid 1980s and the 1990s. Like this poem was published in the Village Voice initially, and it really caused great harm to her career and her relationships. There was a beautifully written and beautifully articulated piece that just came out. Forgive me, I don't remember where it came out. Maybe someone remembers, about June Jordan and Audre Lorde. Yes, yes. LA Review of Books, yeah. And I had a lot of gratitude for that. I mean, I'm someone who is deeply skeptical of intimate writings and journal type shit being published after people are no longer alive. But I thought that was a useful, I mostly just don't want my group chat published when I'm dead. But I say that to say this poem, there's a real sense of self-indictment, and it's not self-indictment that is self-flagellating. It's also June Jordan laying herself at the mercy of those who she believes she's failed. And it is frustrating and devastating to me that to do this harmed her career to a degree that she was failed by people who had nothing to lose. And I think that is what, and to see that not so much has changed, and to see that the people who are risking the most and who have the most to lose are being trampled on and dismissed by people who actually have nothing to lose and have infinite power. This is apologies to all the people in Lebanon. And again, we're going to talk about repetition and anaphora that arrives in this poem and what that repetition does. I didn't know, and nobody told me, and what could I do or say anyway? They said, you shot the London ambassador, and when that wasn't true, they said, so what? They said, you shelled their northern villages, and when UN forces reported that was not true because your side of the ceasefire was holding since more than a year before, they said, so what? They said they wanted simply to carve a 25-mile buffer zone, and then they ravaged your water supplies, your electricity, your hospitals, your schools, your highways and byways, all the way north to Beirut, because they said this was their quest for peace. They blew up your homes and demolished the grocery stores and blocked the Red Cross and took away doctors to jail. And they cluster bombed girls and boys whose bodies swelled purple and black into twice their original size. And they tore the buttocks from a 4-month-old baby. And then they said this was a brilliant military accomplishment. And this was done, they said, in the name of self-defense. They said that is the noblest concept of mankind. Isn't that obvious? They said something about never again. And then they made close to 1 million human beings homeless in less than 3 weeks, and they killed or maimed 40,000 of your men and your women and your children, but I didn't know, and nobody told me, and what could I do or say anyway? They said they were victims. They said you were Arabs. They called your apartments and gardens guerrilla strongholds. They called the screaming devastation they created the rubble, and then they told you to leave, didn't they? Didn't you read the leaflets that they dropped from their hotshot fighter jets? They told you to go. 135,000 Palestinians in Beirut, and why didn't you take the hint? There was a Mediterranean. You could walk into the water and stay there. What was the problem? I didn't know, and nobody told me, and what could I do or say anyway? Yes, I did know it was the money I earned as a poet that paid for the bombs and the planes and the tanks that they used to massacre your family, but I am not an evil person. The people of my country aren't so bad. You can expect but so much from those of us who have to pay taxes and watch American TV. You see my point. I'm sorry. I really am sorry. That poem is also, I think, the obvious thing about that poem that I think people bring up now when they share it and talk about it is that it is very relevant today, obviously, and more important than that, it reflects the reality that that the history of occupation is long and brutal and not something that began recently, and I think that is important for all the reasons we know it's important, right? Because if we do not engage with the history and pretend that occupation is new, then when people say, when reports come out about Israeli snipers shooting Palestinian children, people say, that couldn't possibly happen. They're not thinking about the fact that it has happened for years, right? And when people say, this many members of the press being killed by Israeli snipers, that can't possibly happen. They're not thinking about the fact that that has happened for years. And so to have texts that engage with a violent history of occupation is important. That's one thing. But what I love about this poem too, since I am talking about direct address as a liberatory tool, is that for June Jordan to actually, like the thing that does not get talked about with this poem is that the dedication got added after it was originally published. And before that, when it was just published, the you and the your, like June Jordan did not feel the need to specify that because, again, she was talking both to herself and those who she was trying to bring along towards some sense of liberatory action. And I guess with my last minute, I wasn't going to play another thing, but with my last, like...
You have 7 minutes.
I have 7 minutes? Okay, I'm going to play something. I'm going to play June Jordan reading not that poem, but I'm going to play June Jordan reading I Must Become a Menace to My Enemies, which I think I have queued up. Or no, I'm going to read, I play June Jordan reading Song of the Law-Abiding Citizen, wherein she is embodying, the speaker of the poem is embodying someone who is not June Jordan in the present, but perhaps was in the past. And I am, well, I've got my feelings on persona work. Because so often persona work is just like real talk, like just like a white poet being like, let me just do this poem in the voice of a black person, which we all know. I feel like Maya's not like, I feel like the black poets. Yeah, yes, yes. Right, like Patricia Smith, like Eyes, Cruelty. Cruelty is like one of my favorite books in the world. And instead of that, you know, you just get motherfuckers like, never mind, I ain't gonna, you know. Yeah. Truly, if you, it's one of those, if you know, you know, you know. But I'm going to play June Jordan reading Song of the Law-Abiding Citizen as a kind of last example of address in speaking towards a population. Also, one thing I'm going to say about Song of the Law-Abiding Citizen. Sorry. One thing I'm going to say about Song of the Law-Abiding Citizen is that this is a poem that rhymes, which June Jordan wrote a lot of poems that rhymes, but her delivery of the language is such that the rhymes are kind of like falling into these soft pockets. Here's Song of the Law-Abiding Citizen.
So hot, so what, so hot, so what, so hot, so hot. They made a mistake. I got more than I usually take. I got food stamps, food stamps. I got so many stamps in the mail. I thought maybe I should put them on sale. How lucky I am. I got food stamps, hot damn. I made up my mind to be decent and kind to let my upright character shine. I sent 10,000 food stamps back to the president and his beautiful wife. And I can't pay the rent, but I sent 10,000 food stamps back to the president and his beautiful wife. How lucky I am. I got food stamps. Hot damn. They made a mistake, for Christ's sake, and I gave it away to the president. I thought that was legal. I thought that was kind, and I can't pay the rent, but I sent 10,000 food stamps back to the president. So hot, so hot, so hot, so what, so hot, so what, so hot, so hot. Trucks cruising down the avenue carrying nuclear garbage right next to you, and it's legal, and it's radioaction riding like a regal load of jewels past the bars, this cruel schoolhouse, and the church. And if the trucks wipe out or crash or even lurch around the corner, we will just be goners. And it's legal, and it's radioaction riding regal through the skittery city street. And don't be jittery, because it's legal, radioaction riding the roads, Avenue A, Avenue B, Avenue C, Avenue the avenue of the Americas. So hot, so hot, so hot, so what?
That's Song of the Law-Abiding Citizen. And what is the last two things I'll say about June Jordan? And I, you know, like, I know this is, again, like, very craft heavy and very, like, poem heavy, but that's kind of like, gosh, I came to any revolutionary politic I came to through art making. My mother wrote for this paper. I don't know if people know the, like, Revolutionary Black Paper, 40 Acres, out of New York. I mean, it doesn't exist anymore, but it did in the 60s and 70s. My mom wrote for them. And when I was a kid, my parents were, they had these anti-apartheid buttons around the house. You know, I feel like if you came up, you know, I was born in the early 80s and came up in the 80s, and you maybe remember those, like, end apartheid now buttons, the ones that are kind of, yeah, I mean, I feel like it's very, like, I feel like some black folks that certainly remember those. We had those all over my house. And I remember being like, I don't know what, I was like 5 or 6, and I remember being like, I don't know what that word means. And the way that it was explained to me was in part listening to music and poems, like listening to shit off, like, Shifty Records. And I say that to say, like, I think so much of my strategies around corralling and making useful material action out of my rage, which is endless, is that there is something that funnels through the pursuit of art making that impresses me. Not my own, to be clear, but the art making of others. In June Jordan, if we're thinking about Song of a Long, the Law Abiding Citizen poem, it is almost playful, and I think a lot of her poems are playfully presented in her reading of them. Like, if you listen to a full June Jordan reading, which I also love about her, even not the love poems, like the poems that are steeped in rage, there's a real playfulness to them. But the playfulness is not so that you, the listener or reader, will laugh. It is you understanding that if not this, everything would burn. Like, this is someone who is actually trying to corral a level of rage that is unsustainable. And that in and of itself is a kind of absurdity. That's why I love the reading of that poem, right? Because that poem is being read from the perspective of someone who has nothing and who is watching the world around them be destroyed. And there's this kind of playfulness to it, but it's not a playfulness that, it's a playfulness that is checking the temperature of the room. In the same way, to close us out full circle, in the same way that Angel Reese looked at that woman and said, "Who the fuck are you talking to?" That was checking the temperature of the room, and there's a comma there, right? There's an unspoken comma. It's like a, "Who the fuck are you talking to?" Because, depending, and that comma only exists depending on the person's response, right? And so June Jordan, so many of her poems leave us with this comma. So many of her performances of her poems leave us with this comma, like, what are you going to do? Because there is something that absolutely must be done.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.